Storylines New England is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Our first order of business will be to salute the flag and do the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance.
The town meeting is a long-standing tradition in northern New England, and it's considered one of the purest forms of American democracy. Every March, residents gather in an old hall or school auditorium to act directly as the town's legislative body, discussing and voting on everything from budgets to zoning ordinances. These meetings can go on for hours, but everyone has a vote and everyone has a say, no matter the issue. In a wide-open political setting like this, it's not surprising that things sometimes get personal.
Does not require anyone to second it. You are disqualified. Please step aside.
All right, you have delivered me your point of order, asking me to step down. The people of this town have elected me to do this job, and I'm going to do it. Thank you very much.
The town meetings in Guilford, New Hampshire, have been held annually for 192 years, a rich tradition of political theater, local characters, and intense rivalries. Yet Guilford citizens have always relied on this meeting not just to conduct the town's business, but to take its political temperature as well. This year, however, moderator Peter Millam greeted residents with words no previous gathering has heard in almost two centuries.
Welcome to Guilford's last conventional town meeting.
The people of Guilford, New Hampshire, have decided that they've outgrown their town meeting, partly because the town is getting too big for this collective style of governing, partly because of simple apathy, and partly because the thousands of outsiders who have moved into Guilford feel far less connected to the ebb and flow of small-town politics. Guilford's decision to abandon its unwieldy tradition is not unique. All over northern New England, the old ways are losing their influence in the face of rapid growth and change. In a way, the real surprise is that institutions like town meetings have lasted as long as they have. The truth is that, for a very long time, New England's political attitudes and practices, once the undisputed bedrock of the country's revolutionary form of governance, have been losing their influence on the American scene as a whole. Since the early decades of the 19th century, New England's electoral votes, its representation in Congress, and its power to shape national policy have all been steadily shrinking. The decline has been such that some contemporary political figures have no problem declaring New England out of touch with the rest of America. Still, reports of the region's political demise may be somewhat exaggerated. Guilford, New Hampshire town moderator Peter Millam.
I think New England is very well represented. New England representatives seem to be fairly strong in the positions of power in Congress and the Senate. Whether you want to be Republican or Democrat, that the representatives that we have are pretty good representatives. The question will be whether they will have the power nationally that we used to have as a region. Time will tell, and I won't be around to see the answer to that.
From the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Storylines New England. Coming up, we look at the influence of New England through a famous book by an American literary icon whose writings are steeped in New England political beliefs. I'm Laura Kanoy.
And I'm Kevin Gardner. Storylines is a special 13-part radio project of the American Library Association that looks at the literature of New England as a way to better understand who we are as New Englanders and Americans. But Storylines is more than just a show about books. Each week, we'll address a particular New England author's work and look at the issues that each book raises as we search for insights about where we've been, where we are now, and where we're heading. This week on Storylines, a look at New England's political influence, past, present, and future, through Mark Twain's A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court.
Mark Twain has been called the Lincoln of our literature. As some have called Hemingway our premier novelist and Frost our top poet, many refer to Mark Twain as our greatest satirist. Yet those who are familiar with Twain, those who've read him in school or reread him as adults, might not instantly get the New England connection. Think Mark Twain and you probably think steamboats, the Mississippi River, even his boyhood home, Hannibal, Missouri. But what you might not know about Twain is that from the 1870s until his death in 1910, Twain made his home in Hartford, Connecticut, a place he lived in longer than any other single town. And although Twain's earlier novels, like Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, evoke his Midwestern childhood, a deeply New England kind of idealism emerges in his later writings. Nowhere is this more so than in his 1889 novel, A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, the story of a Yankee factory foreman who travels back to the time of King Arthur and tries to impose his democratic 19th century ways on 6th century England, with catastrophic results. Twain was never shy about his political beliefs, and in this book, he lays them out forcefully on page after page.
I was from Connecticut, whose constitution declares that all political power is inherent in the people, and all free governments are founded on their authority and instituted for their benefit, and that they have at all times an undeniable and indefeasible right to alter their form of government in such a manner as they may think expedient. Under that gospel, the citizen who thinks he sees that Commonwealth's political clothes are worn out and yet holds his peace and does not agitate for a new suit is disloyal. He is a traitor. That he may be the only one who thinks he sees this decay does not excuse him. It is his duty to agitate anyway, and it is the duty of the others to vote him down if they do not see the matter as he does.
Mark Twain wrote A Connecticut Yankee at a time when many Americans still had strong memories of the Civil War and a divided country, when technology, industry, and science were bringing profound change to almost every aspect of daily life, and as America prepared to transform itself into an imperial power at the dawn of the 20th century. It was also a time when New England, long considered the cradle of democracy, was beginning to see a decline in its political influence. New England's elite prep schools, colleges, and Ivy League universities had educated and formed the values and beliefs of presidents from John Adams to Franklin Pierce to Theodore Roosevelt, and in Twain's time were still considered centers of political, technological, and spiritual innovation. Today, more than a century after the publication of A Connecticut Yankee, New England sees itself in a much different light. As populations have expanded elsewhere, New England has seen its electoral vote shrink steadily since John Adams's election. The region's representatives are now far less proportionately significant in Congress than at any other time in our history. And in recent decades, New England's votes and New England's issues have surrendered even more of their former prominence in the national agenda. Now, as we approach another presidential election, many Americans even consider a New England upbringing a liability, an incubator of attitudes and political opinions somehow out of touch with the rest of the country.
Today on Storylines New England, we look at Mark Twain's A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, and we'll talk about New England's political traditions and influences. Mark Twain played on the region's and the country's political, technological, and spiritual idealism throughout his book, but also explicitly described the dangers of imposing those beliefs on other countries and cultures. There's almost an eerie relevance to his writing, given America's current relations with the rest of the world, and A Connecticut Yankee reminds us that many of the issues that drive contemporary social and political debate are far from new.
As we explore Mark Twain and New England politics, we want to hear from you. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. How do you think the rest of the country perceives New England and its politics? How does Twain's criticism of American attitudes still resonate? And as we near the elections of 2004, can a New Englander attract national support for political office? Again, our number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477.
Joining us now in the studio is Garrison Nelson, professor of political science and American government at the University of Vermont. He's authored several books on the U.S. Congress and a forthcoming book on New England politics. Garrison Nelson, thanks for making the trip. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Enjoy being here, Laura.
Joining us from the studios of Connecticut Public Radio, Paul Lauter, professor of English at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. And Paul Lauter, welcome to you. Thanks for your time.
Well, thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Paul, I'm going to start with you. What New England values does A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court reflect?
Well, a lot of the skepticism about religion, to start with, in a peculiar way, particularly the opposition to Catholicism and the notion of a foreign religion, that certainly is one of the elements there. It reflects a skepticism about a monarchical form of government, a hierarchical form of government as distinct from democracy. And it also begins to introduce the question of violence in political affairs, and the question that has a great deal of resonance today and was very resonant at the time. And New England, is very paradoxical in its politics and in its technology. If you think about the joke about the New Englander peddling wooden nutmegs throughout the American colonies, the New Englander pushing new weapons, and at the same time the New Englander pushing, as in James Fenimore Cooper, for example, pushing an idea of religious singing, of all things, and there are all of these paradoxes that Twain is picking up on right from the beginning.
Garrison Nelson, I'd love your take on that question too. The specifically New England values or attitudes reflected in this book.
Well, I think I agree with Paul about the skepticism. But it was a time of great transition in New England, and of course part of that transition was the sort of the second major wave of Catholics that were coming into the region. And the first major wave of the 1840s, who were the Irish who settled in Boston and settled along much of southern New England, had an enormous impact upon the politics of the region. And by Twain's time in 1889, we're seeing the second major wave, the Gilded Age, the arrival of the Italians and the Poles and the French Canadians, who also changed the politics and basically end up as the allies of the Irish ward bosses who mobilize Catholics because the Irish can speak English and the other Catholics can't, and who are able to use these sort of to create the city machines.
Garrison, did you how did Twain respond to the political climate that he found in New England at the time he began to write? Do you think that his do you think that his attitudes and opinions were already set when he sat down to do King Arthur's Court?
Yeah, well, he's kind of the tradition of sort of the Protestant artisan, refers to the Presbyterian Church, which is really what he wants to create for King Arthur's time. Mm-hmm. So, but it's that New England mechanic, the person, the tinkerer, the person who basically changes the world through mechanical inventions.
We have a little section early on in Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court where Twain is talking about exactly these things.
I am an American. I was born and reared in Hartford, in the state of Connecticut, anyway, just over the river in the country. So I am a Yankee of the Yankees, and a practical, yes, and nearly barren of sentiment, I suppose, or poetry, in other words. My father was a blacksmith, my uncle was a horse doctor, and I was both, along at first. Then I went over to the great arms factory and learned my real trade, learned all there was to it, learned to make everything. Guns, revolvers, cannon, boilers, engines, all sorts of labor-saving machinery. Why, I could make anything a body wanted, anything in the world. It didn't make any difference what. And if there wasn't any quick, newfangled way to make a thing, I could invent one and do it as easy as rolling off a log. I became head superintendent, had a couple of thousand men under me. Well, a man like that is a man that is full of fight. That goes without saying. With a couple of thousand rough men under one, one has plenty of that sort of amusement. I had, anyway. At last, I met my match, and I got my dose. It was during a misunderstanding conducted with crowbars with a fellow we used to call Hercules. He laid me out with a crusher alongside the head that made everything crack and seemed to spring every joint in my skull and make it overlap its neighbor. Then the world went out in darkness, and I didn't feel anything more and didn't know anything at all, at least for a while.
A reading from Mark Twain's A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, showing his Yankee ingenuity, his self-confidence, and also telling the story of just how he goes back in time to King Arthur's England, tries to impose his 19th century New England values on that era. And we're talking today on Storylines New England about New England's politics, about our region's political identity and its waning national influence. We're exploring the issue through the pages of Mark Twain's novel, A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. We want to hear from you, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. What New England attitudes does Mark Twain's character show in this book? And are Twain's criticism of American attitudes still relevant today? Also, later on, we'll talk about how New England's politics are perceived elsewhere. Join us with your thoughts, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy, along with Kevin Gardner. Our guests today are Paul Lauder, professor of English at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut, and Garrison Nelson, professor of political science and American government at the University of Vermont. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And Paul Lauder, I'll turn to you. What was Twain's connection to New England, to this Yankee of all Yankees, as he said in that tape? Because when most people think of Twain, they think of, you know, the mighty Mississippi River and the Midwest and Hannibal, Missouri.
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. In fact, almost all of Twain's most famous works, longer ones, were written while he was a resident of Hartford, moved to Hartford in 1871, and essentially retained the house on in Nook Farm until late in the 19th century, actually later than that, although he didn't live in it after his daughter died there. So from 1871 essentially on, Twain was a resident of New England. But he was more of a New Englander than that. He was deeply involved in the Hartford community in a great variety of ways. He was involved with the Hartford African American community, which was substantial even in the late 19th century. He was involved in another way as an attempted industrialist. You know that Twain tried to get rich through schemes that had to do both with publishing and also with the page compositor, a device that he thought would really bring in a lot of money. As it turned out, the compositor proved to be fairly impractical as a commercial form of setting type, and it failed. The company failed. Twain ended up in bankruptcy. But as resident of Hartford, he was deeply involved in this community in a variety of ways, and that's also reflected in A Connecticut Yankee, because Hank Morgan, as the reading just expressed, was conceived of as the foreman, the superintendent of an arms factory. Well, the arms factory he was superintendent of is the Colt factory, and the Colt factory and the Colt family was a very central, a very significant player in the world of Hartford, both before and after the Civil War. So, and Hartford itself was a central publishing place for not just New England, but for the nation. And Twain was involved in that. One of the primary reasons he moved to Hartford, in the first place, was in order to be closer to his own publisher. So, in a whole variety of ways, Twain was situated here, situated on the same property as Harriet Beecher Stowe, the quintessential New England writer.
Garrison Nelson, I wonder if you would fill in a few details for us about the literal explosion of technology at the end of the 19th century in America. It was a time that had people of that era reeling almost as much as the technical explosions of our own time have us in shock.
Well, of course, I remember the old crack about Colt, you know, and you say God made big men, God made small men, Colt made the revolver to even things out. But yeah, it was, New England was prospering at that particular point in terms of manufacturing. New England always had to be ingenious. I come from Massachusetts, from next to Saugus, Mass, which had the first ironworks in the colonies, and so consequently, one of the reasons that we had to be ingenious is that our land stunk. We couldn't grow very much except rocks, and so we had to be very creative. And so much of Yankee ingenuity was born of necessity. And certainly, you know, Samuel F. B. Morse, Morse Telegraph, who's once again the anti-Catholic theme, led the American Party, which was a big hit in New England. But so those are some things that we saw developing, and of course, the some of the great fortunes, but that also, you know, arrived. Now, Connecticut, in particular, Connecticut was really an adjunct of New York State politically during that time, and voted for Grover Cleveland three times when the nation only did twice. And so it was a so Connecticut was kind of caught in a tension between sort of the Boston-centered politics of much of New England and the New York-driven politics of the large city machine. So Connecticut's political ambivalence was really very much in evidence in Twain's time.
Paul Lauder, we've heard about Twain's enthusiasm for certain things technological from you. How does is it fair to say, I guess, that Twain is not wholly enthusiastic about the effects of exploding technology? And how does that reflect itself in the Connecticut Yankee?
Oh, in the novel, Hank begins to think that he can impose technological solutions on a whole series of problems, starting a telephone exchange and introducing a bicycle, and most of all, in the long run, introducing, to use current jargon, what amounted to weapons of mass destruction, that is, guns and gunpowder. And as he begins to impose this technologically driven set of ideas, hoping thereby to gain control over the King Arthur's court and oppose the magicians and the superstition and the religious backwardness, gradually what happens is that things spin out of control. And you end up in a situation, it's one of the most barren, bleak pieces of writing that I know of at the end of the book, where what in effect has happened is that the killing of the knights of the Round Table and of opposition to Hank's progressive ideas, the killing traps Hank and his followers in what amounts to a plague. And so technology, as it turns out in the book, becomes a form of self-defeat, becomes a form of destroying the very people who have produced the technology. It's thereby a very bleak vision. And it's not a vision that was unusual in New England, because some of the inventors of factories in New England, in Lowell and Lawrence and the places where the...
I think, Paul Lauder, are you still with us? Or did we lose that connection all of a sudden? Mr. Lauder? All right. You know, I'm glad that he mentioned that very bleak scenario, because we have a reading right now that we're going to play that shows what happens, or at least Twain's warning and vision of what happens, about applying technology to warfare.
I sent a current through the third fence now, and almost immediately through the fourth and fifth, so quickly were the gaps filled up. I believed the time was come now for my climax. I believed that That whole army was in our trap. Anyway, it was high time to find out. So I touched a button and set 50 electric suns aflame on the top of our precipice. Land! What a sight! We were enclosed in three walls of dead men. All the other fences were pretty nearly filled with the living, who were stealthily working their way forward through the wires. The sudden glare paralyzed this host, petrified them, you may say, with astonishment. There was just one instant for me to utilize their immobility in, and I didn't lose the chance. You see, in another instant, they would have recovered their faculties. Then they'd have burst into a cheer and made a rush, and my wires would have gone down before it. But that lost instant lost them in their opportunity forever, while even that slight fragment of time was still unspent. I shot the current through all the fences and struck the whole host dead in their tracks. There was a groan you could hear. It voiced the death pang of 11,000 men. It swelled out on the night with awful pathos.
A scene read from the ending of Mark Twain's A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. And today on Storylines New England, we are looking at this book to explore several issues. One, New England's role in American political life, and also New England's role in advancing technology. We want to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Mark Twain's novel is the story of a 19th century New Englander who travels back in time and imposes his values and technology on King Arthur's England. Join us with your calls. How do you think New England's politics and influence are still perceived today? Do you think that our influence and our attitudes have changed since the days of A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court? Join us 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. We will be taking your phone calls after a short break. Again, that number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR.
For more information on Storylines New England or the books that we're reading, visit our website, storyline.ala.org, or check out your local public library. Libraries have copies of the books, program schedules, and our discussion guides.
We'd like to say hello this week to our listeners in Connecticut, listening on Connecticut Public Radio, also listening in Deep River Public, the patrons of Deep River Public Library, Naugatuck Public Library. Also, we welcome this week WBUR and Boston Public Libraries and other listeners in Massachusetts, especially patrons of the West Tisbury and Northfield Public Libraries. You're listening to Storylines New England. I'm Laura Canoy.
And I'm Kevin Gardner.
Project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities.
From the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Storylines New England. I'm Laura Kanoy.
And I'm Kevin Gardner. Each week on Storylines, we look at a particular New England author's work as a way to try and better understand who we are as New Englanders, where we've been, where we are, and where we're heading. Today we're looking at politics and technology and New England's declining influence in the pages of Mark Twain's A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, a darkly satirical tale of a time-traveling Yankee who tries to install 19th-century American values in 6th-century England, with catastrophic results. Although it was written well over 100 years ago, Twain's book remains astonishingly relevant to New England and America in 2004. His warnings against the forced imposition of democracy on foreign cultures seem fresh as this morning's headlines. His treatment of New England's political credos recall the charges and countercharges of current presidential debates, and his catastrophic climax with its thousands of dead seems utterly familiar to anyone who watches television news.
Yet despite its futurist significance and its cataclysmic ending, Twain's book is also funny, skeptical, humane, ironic, and very New England. Twain spent the final 40 years of his life in Hartford, Connecticut, and even though the author is rightly associated with America's Mississippi River heartland, his politics and social outlook also reflect much of the attitude of his adopted region. Nowhere is this more evident than in his late, highly complex novel, A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, a book filled with acidic reflections on America's political ideals and technological innovations, and dryly humorous passages typical of Twain, such as this account of an attempt to teach Arthurian knights what was, in Twain's time, a relatively new American pastime.
This experiment was baseball. In order to give the thing a vogue from the start and place it out of the reach of criticism, I chose my nines by rank, not capacity. There wasn't a knight in either team who wasn't a sceptered sovereign. As for material of this sort, there was a glut of it, always, around Arthur. You couldn't throw a brick in any direction and not cripple a king. Of course, I couldn't get these people to leave off their armor. They wouldn't do that when they bathed. They consented to differentiate the armor so that a body could tell one team from the other, but that was the most they would do. So one of the teams wore chainmail ulsters and the other wore plate armor made of my new Bessemer steel. Their practice on the field was the most fantastic thing I ever saw. Being ball-proof, they never skipped out of the way, but stood still and took the result when a Bessemer was at the bat and a ball hit him. It would bound 150 yards sometimes, and when a man was running and threw himself on his stomach to slide to his base, it was like an ironclad coming into port. At first, I appointed men of no rank to act as umpires, but I had to discontinue that. These people were no easier to please than other nines. The umpire's first decision was usually his last. They broke him in two with a bat, and his friends toted him home on a shutter. When it was noticed that no umpire ever survived a game, umpiring got to be unpopular, so I was obliged to appoint somebody whose rank and a lofty position under the government would protect him.
Today on Storylines New England, we're talking about Mark Twain's A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, and we're looking at New England's role in politics, past, present, and future. Twain's satirical tale of an arrogant Yankee who destroys Arthurian England by trying to improve it raises all sorts of questions about New England's and America's tendency to impose its politics and its morality on others. Now, as populations have shifted and as America's West and South have overshadowed the Northeast, New England's political and cultural roles have changed dramatically.
As we explore these issues, we want to hear from you. Call us at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. What in Twain's book do you find most relevant today? What do you think New England's political place is in the country as a whole? And as America prepares for a presidential election, is a New England background an asset or a liability? Again, join us at 1-800-892-6477. Our guests in studio, Garrison Nelson, Professor of Political Science and American Government at the University of Vermont, and joining us from Connecticut Public Radio, Paul Lauter, Professor of English at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. And I'll turn to you first, Garrison Nelson. I want to talk about New England's political influence in America. First, at the time when mm-hmm. Twain wrote this book, 1889, just before the last turn of the century, and then how that New England influence has changed. So first of all, just how important was New England politically at that time?
Very important. This is the 1880s, extraordinarily important. One of the key figures, of course, in New England at the time was James G. Blaine, who was born in Pennsylvania but ran from the state of Maine. Blaine, James G. Blaine, continental liar from the state of Maine, as the slogan was in 1884. And he actually moved to Maine in some ways to run for office. And,
so his name would rhyme.
Not quite, but so we have a case of someone not running from New England to run elsewhere, as the Bush family has done, but Blaine moving to New England.
So it was an asset then.
It was a clear asset. Maine was a powerhouse at that point. Blaine had been Speaker of the House, and Tom Reed, Czar Reed, was soon to become Speaker of the House, also from Maine. The Vice President of the United States, Chester Arthur, who was born in Vermont but elected from New York, and of course became president when Garfield was murdered. Garfield's mother and father were New Hampshire natives. So we have, and as Arthur's mother was also a New Hampshire native. So we have these. So we have a very strong New England connection during the 1880s. Benjamin Harrison, who becomes president in 1888, his vice president, Levi Morton, is born in the shore of Vermont. So we have this very strong New England culture that is making its way into national politics. And then it sort of falls, then it disappears.
Well, right. Jump forward for us, if you could, Garrison, to today. I mean, how important would you say New England is today in terms of national politics?
Well, it's amazing.
And what happened between, you know, Mark Twain's era and now?
And now. Well, right now, New England has 6.3% of the total electoral vote in the nation, which is only 34 electoral votes, which means we're basically equal to Texas. So that's about it. Once upon a time, we had 55 electoral votes, and after Vermont came into the Union, New England held 29% of the electoral votes. And, of course, the first vice president was, John Adams from Massachusetts, and as I always like to say, a father of a president was back in 1790s, and now we have the son of a president, and of course W. Bush was born in Connecticut. He is the first Connecticut-born president, so which is kind of remarkable. Joe Lieberman and Ralph Nader are all Connecticut natives. So Connecticut kind of had an eruption of influence in the 2000 election. Of course, Bush is not a Connecticut Yankee. He's a Connecticut cowboy, as we now realize, and has clearly distanced himself as much as possible from sort of his New England roots. Daddy was always ambivalent about his New England heritage. But, of course, what real New England's influence now is in terms of education. The fact that so many candidates have been graduates of Yale and Harvard, particularly Yale. Yale has just there's been a Yale person, Yale-educated nominee on a major party for president or vice president every single election since 1972, yep. Nine elections in a row.
And they have, and the two of them are running against each other now.
as they did earlier. Also, one of the things that we also see with is an interesting Harvard-Yale connection. Bill Clinton, of course, had graduated Yale Law, and Al Gore, graduate of Harvard. The last time we had Harvard and Yale in the presidency and vice presidency was when John Quincy Adams and John Calhoun served together, not amicably, but back in 1825.
You're listening to Storylines New England. I'm Kevin Gardner, along with Laura Kanoy, and we're talking about Mark Twain and New England politics with Garrison Nelson and Paul Lauter. And we'd like you to join us at 1-800-892-6477. Paul Lauter, I want to follow up on Garrison Nelson's primer about the dominance of the influence of New England politics at the time Mark Twain was writing by asking you to give us a little similar primer about the state of literary production in the late 19th century with respect to politics. In other words, were there other American writers and New England writers who were doing the kinds of politically informed writing that Mark Twain was doing?
Well, yeah. In fact, you can look at a lot of late 19th century writing as reflecting the political issues of the time. Right from the beginning, when Twain came to Connecticut, he wrote with Charles Dudley Warner, who was the publisher of the Hartford Courant. He wrote The Gilded Age, which gave a name to that entire age of enormous accumulation of wealth and maldistribution of wealth as well, one might point out. But someone like Hamlin Garland, for example, was writing in novels and in stories about the hardships of farm families in the Middle West. Harriet Beecher Stowe herself, having moved from the issue of slavery into a variety of other issues, trying to find a way of recapturing the kind of moral certitude and values of an earlier New England without its terrorizing theology. Henry Adams, talk about the Adams family, writing a novel like Democracy, which is an enormous satire on the Congress. He writes at one point, you know, a congressman is a hog. What you have to do is beat him over the snout with a stick. And then in his other writings, really politically sharp. It is a time in which what you have sustained in the late 19th century is the view dominant in the earlier 19th century in New England that writing is not about primarily aesthetics. It's about primarily values and politics.
Paul Lauder and Garrison Nelson, let's go to the phones, 1-800-892-6477, to Rochester, Vermont first, and Julia is up on Storylines New England. Hi, Julia, go ahead.
Hi, thanks very much.
Sure.
I'm approaching your subject sort of from the opposite perspective. I've never read the novel, although I've been an English instructor of literature and composition, and so I know Twain's work fairly well. And I'm a native Vermonter. I returned back here 2 years after living for 20 years in the Pacific Northwest. And the whole time I was out there, I couldn't avoid noticing the attitude of Westerners towards Easterners, which is, I think, germane. And I think it has a historical basis. I think the two parts of the country really don't know too much about each other. And I think there's a big schism there. And it's ironic, even though a lot of the West was settled by Easterners, Vermonters, people from Maine, and so forth. So it's
well, how would you describe the difference, Julia, between the political attitudes of East and West?
Well, the Westerners are quite suspicious of Easterners. I think part of that, you mentioned Hamlin Garland and that era, I think part of that is because so much money flowed from east to west through the banks, and then banks would foreclose on ranches and farms, and it got traced back to, you know, the nasty bankers in New York.
Against those honest farmers and ranchers out west.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think as people went across the country in the Western migration, and, you know, starting in 1842, they found out that maybe they didn't need to toe the line quite as strictly because they had to be resourceful and be creative, and so they shed a lot of the traditional viewpoints and the ways of doing things that Easterners still use today.
You know,
and so then they turn around and say, well, that's silly. Why are you Easterners acting like that?
Julia, I am so glad you called. Garrison Nelson, the point that she brings up is so interesting, and I have noticed it too. Do you sense a suspicion by the rest of the country of New Englanders and our politics?
Yes. Because there's this sense that we condescend to them. And we certainly see this in the reaction to John Kerry, that New England just think they're so much smarter, that they're just so much better bred, so much better educated, and they have a tendency to look down upon us. By the way, the Oregon, which is a unique western state, Oregon was not settled overland or settled around the horn. And the first four settlements in Oregon, Portland, Salem, Harrisburg, and Albany. So it was kind of an eastern encampment out in the West Coast. But I think this is that superiority which they feel that New Englanders bring to the table, which offends them. And that goes back way back to the reply to Hayne, Daniel Webster, where basically Massachusetts is chastised vigorously on the floor of the Senate by Senator Robert Hayne of South Carolina. And, of course, Daniel Webster, in his wonderful speech, the second reply, has to defend Massachusetts. And here we have sort of Massachusetts being attacked rather vigorously in the third debate by the President of the United States in three separate references. So, bashing Massachusetts is something which has become a kind of a political pastime.
What do you think, Paul Lauder, of this issue? Go ahead.
It's a funny paradox because it is true that from the city upon the hill, Winthrop's phrase, and not unusually President Reagan's favorite phrase, from the city upon a hill, you are looking downward, right, at people. And yet the fact of the matter is that it was something that Reagan saw as a Californian, after all, central to the culture of the United States. That notion of exporting culture and education has been very central to New England, and it still is. I just came today from the inauguration of the new president of Trinity, and his talk was precisely about that notion of not just a city upon a hill, but an institution upon a hill, a school, which he associated with the school of Athens in the time of Plato and Aristotle, with the medieval monks writing from a hill overlooking the Irish Sea. And that notion that New England is itself a cradle of not just democracy, but of education, of wisdom, of culture, I'm sure from some points of view can be seen as offensive. On the other hand, to pick up President Reagan's phrase, the city upon the hill is also seen as a positive element of American democracy. So it's again one of those odd paradoxes.
Julia, thank you so much for that call. Let's go to Laconia, New Hampshire, and talk to Anne. Anne, you're on Storylines New England. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. I called because I have a CD. It's called The Best of Hal Holbrook, Mark Twain Tonight. And Holbrook, you know, went around for years, and apparently three LPs were made, and then the CD is a condensation of them. And I happened to listen to it for the first time during the buildup for the invasion of Iraq. And in it, and I don't know which of his works this is from, I think much of this is where he debunks convention and debunks, you know, conventional morality and stuff. But anyway, he said, the first thing they tell you is you have to go to war, and the second thing they tell you is you have to stay there. And I have not been able to get that out of my mind ever since. I've listened to it several times since. But it's just I don't know which. The liner notes don't tell you. You know, Holbrook was using, it was all Mark Twain's work.
Oh, well, Anne, Mark Twain was a famous raconteur and probably the most famous public speaker in America for quite some time. It's quite possible that those words just came out of his mouth one night when he was standing in front of an audience and were never in a piece of literature. But I want to follow up with that with you, Paul Lauder, and ask you to tell us a little bit about Twain, the off-the-cuff commentator, the famous political celebrity. What kind of an impact did Twain's existence as a constant talking head, so to speak, have in American politics and American literature at the turn of the century?
Well, it's hard to determine the influence. He was a very active figure at the turn of the century in the Anti-Imperialist League. He was the vice president of the Anti-Imperialist League from 1901 to his death in 1910. And he wrote a whole series of essays and stories, like To the Person Sitting in Darkness, and which embody a view of the role of the United States, in effect. He says somewhere or another he doesn't want to see the eagle attacking, picking on other people. So he turned his fame, which was, as you say, very widespread, to a particular kind of politics, anti-imperialism. It's a funny phrase to most Americans nowadays, although it's certainly been on many people's lips. It's hard to say exactly what his influence was, but he certainly put his fame and his ability to go around the world and talk to a very specifically political end. And not just that, he also wrote something called The United States of Lynchardom, right at the height of the Jim Crow kind of legislation that was being passed and implemented in the South, the height of lynching of African American people. So Twain was in those ways and in many others, not in certain ways, like, you know, the only Indian is a dead Indian, but he was certainly very progressive on most issues having to do with war, having to do with race. And that's one of the reasons that a book like A Connecticut Yankee reverberates so much now.
He has spent considerable amount of time defending himself against accusations of being a traitor to this country, too, didn't he?
Yes, that's true. And the politics of the late 19th century were no neater and nicer than they are now.
Let's go back to our callers, 1-800-892-6477. This is Storylines New England. I'm Laura Kanoy, along with Kevin Gardner. We're talking about Mark Twain, New England politics today with Garrison Nelson and Paul Lauder. The book we're looking at is Twain's A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. To Hebron, New Hampshire next, and Vin joins us from there. Hi, Vin, go ahead.
Good evening. Yeah, I first read the book, and the last time I read it was when I was in ninth grade, and I think a lot of the political commentary went right by me. But going back and thinking back of it as you all were talking tonight, I went back actually just for looked at the back end of the book, and at the very end of it, after I guess there's just been a slaughter, a woman appears and says, "Ye were conquerors, ye are conquered. These others are perishing, you also." And the woman, in a couple of sentences later, identifies herself as Merlin. But it struck me, it brought back the whole anti-imperialism thing. And there were so many different, I guess, anti-imperialist echoes from The Heart of Darkness by Conrad, for example. But the whole idea of people going in, some with intentions of greed, some with very good intentions, the way it sounds like the Connecticut Yankee went in.
You know, Vin, this is a great point. And Garrison, when this book was written in 1889, you know, America was embarking on this imperialist era. We were really at the dawn of this time. What were people thinking, saying, talking about this coming era of American imperialism?
They were,
especially people in New England, we should say.
In New England, it had a political casualty. Tom Reed of Maine, left the speakership as a consequence of our effort to kind of annex Hawaii.
He was the Speaker of the U.S. House.
He was the Speaker of the U.S. House, and he left over that conflict with President McKinley. And so anti-imperialism sort of took Reed basically out of Congress. The Republican Party was very much enmeshed in this, and of course Theodore Roosevelt became the great sort of war hero, military hero of the Spanish-American War in 1898, and George Dewey of Vermont, who became the great naval hero of the Spanish-American War, because defeating the Spaniards in the Battle of Manila Bay. So New England was sort of caught up in this. Once again, New Englanders have always been kind of aggressive expansionists in many ways, but there was ambivalence within the region. And of course, most of the stuff. Well, I'm not saying most of the stuff. This was because it's the Philippines and Hawaii in the Pacific, and of course Puerto Rico and Cuba in the Caribbean. So we have a unique set of circumstances here, where, as I say, New England was split politically on this issue.
Paul Lauder, yeah. Laura and I, in preparing for this program, were so struck by how fresh Twain's writing is today. And we wanted to ask you, does Twain have anything like a legacy in American letters or an American commentary? And what is it about him, about his way of putting things, aside from content, that makes him so fresh?
Well, you remember Hemingway's famous phrase that all American literature begins with one book, Huckleberry Finn by Mark Twain. And it's certainly the case that Twain's style, his use of vernacular in particular, it's not an elevated style. The excerpts that you've been playing, providing Hank Morgan's voice, it's the voice of an ordinary Connecticut guy, right? Just as Huckleberry Finn is the voice of an ordinary boy from the Middle West. That's, I think, the key. A wonderful ear for picking up a variety of voices, whether they're New Englanders or African Americans from the South or a kid from Hannibal. That is one of the critical things. And the other is the intensity of values that he's always there. There are always issues, and you confront the issues not with the snooty high style of that one might associate with somebody like Henry Adams, for example, but the guy next door who seems to be talking right to you.
You know, very quickly, Garrison, who on our contemporary scene reflects Twain? Michael Moore, Jon Stewart, or conservative humorist P.J. O'Rourke? What do you think?
O'Rourke is the best writer. And I'll leave it there.
All right. And we will leave it there. And Garrison Nelson, thank you very much. I appreciate you coming in. Garrison Nelson, professor of political science and American government at the University of Vermont. And Paul Lauder, thanks to you, too. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
From the studios of Connecticut Public Radio, Paul Lauder joined us, professor of English at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. For more information about Storylines New England or the books in our series, visit our website at storylines.ala.org or visit your local public library. Many libraries in your area will have copies of the books, program schedules, tapes of past shows, even discussion guides.
Storylines New England is produced by Keith Shields. Our engineer is Andrew Walsh. We had production help from Dan Colgan and Ty Fraley. Special thanks today to Jerry Morin at Lakes Region Public Access Television.
Pat Tierney performed our readings today. Our library discussion guides were written by Bill Ott. Georgia Lomax coordinates the participating libraries.
The executive producer of the Storylines America Project is Paul Zales.
Storylines New England comes to you from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio in Concord, New Hampshire. I'm Laura Kanoy.
And I'm Kevin Gardner. Join us next week for Storylines New England.
Storylines New England is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Next time on Storylines New England, the plight of urban New England and Michael Patrick McDonald's All Souls.
McDonald's memoir of life in the tough Irish Catholic housing projects of South Boston, Massachusetts, brings us many of the same issues that concern New England and American cities today. Drugs, crime, suicide, and race and class warfare.
Through the pages of All Souls, we examine the state of our cities on the next Storylines New England.